good to be here.
Starting out with a smirk from Brad.
Gotta get that smirk.
You know, every time I tell myself I'm going to say something, I'm going to do something, and then you guys do that, and I have the same crap-eating grin on my face. Every time.
Every single time.
Dude, it's the perfect grin, as Brad was telling us before we started recording that he's going to this corporate dinner, and he's just getting used to what his face should look like as he's working his way up that corporate ladder.
That's right. I'm now smooth, and I still look old because I don't have any hair, but you get the idea.
He shaved his face, ladies and gentlemen. He had a burly beard, and it's gone. He's getting ready for the big shots that don't appreciate the beard maybe as much as they should. And James is ready to curse both of our names because we don't have enough facial hair, but he's holding it down for the group, so don't you worry.
I have hair on behalf of the group.
It's true. One of us needs to have a full head of hair. One of us needs to have that Hollywood, California beautiful hair, and there's just one of us, guys. And that's why you should give to our Patreon, so that Brad and I can get hair plugs, so that we can get that nice full head of hair going again, so we can look like Matthew McConaughey after that interesting year where he went from not a lot of hair to a beautiful head of hair. Matthew, if you're listening, I love you. All right.
I feel like what we should probably do is start a project where we have people give money, and I'll grow my hair out long enough that I can then cut it off, and we'll pay to have wigs made for y'all out of my hair.
Wigs. The correct term for men is toupee, James.
No. Toupee would be like a short, fashionable thing. Yeah. I mean a wig. I want y'all to be like to the shoulders,
oh my gosh,
looking good.
Looking like we're in the 70s, just flower children. Just ready.
You give me 2 years, and I could have two wigs made.
Enough hair for Brad
for,
and I.
Y'all to have hair down to the shoulders.
Dude, I'm just imagining the look on Megan's face and on Hannah's face, and they're like, yes, we have our college-age men again, where they had hair back in the day when they were beautiful. Even though both of our wives didn't know us in college, technically, they've seen pictures. They know what could have been, and they know what they've lost.
Right. Right, so not only has my wife seen me in college pictures, but this last weekend we were at my parents' house, so we have to make this like book of pictures to give to birth moms for this adoption thing. So Megan wanted to get some old pictures of me when I was a kid, so she's now went through like my entire life of pictures.
Ooh.
When I had so much hair that I used to have to thin it out every time.
You had to thin it out?
Yeah, they used to have these shears would like cut some and not the other.
Yeah. And
that tells us something that David had no idea that existed.
No, I had zero reason to thin my hair out. I instantly knew what
you were talking about, and I have recently had that done.
Yeah. So y'all both had an overabundance of hair that they actually had specific scissors to thin that hair out. I think my wife's hair is that thick as well. I was hoping our son would get it. He did not. Our son absolutely has my hair, so he will be bald by 18. He will embrace it. Because if you think about it, like, I don't know about your dad, Brad, but my dad didn't go bald until, I mean, I don't think he was in his late 30s, maybe 40s. Mine's hit a little bit earlier than it hit him. Did you go bald quicker than your dad did, to your knowledge?
I think so. I mean, at this point, I have less hair than he does total.
So the answer is yes. Then you are winning at the game. You are winning at the game of baldness.
Right. Right. If that's a game, I'm winning.
So I'm super worried about my son. Like, I'm like, is he going to have hair? Like, period? Like, he's supposed to grow it in. I'm hoping it'll happen.
There was about a year and a half, where every time I would go get my hair cut, I would contemplate if I was just going to buzz it off and just give up, you know?
Yep, I know that. James, people go through that. I know you haven't experienced that, but...
Yeah, I don't know.
But even in the 4.5 years that Megan and I have been married, looking even at our wedding photos...
Yeah, you had more hair. I like posting those pictures of you because you look better.
I only have one grandfather living right now, but he's in his 90s and full head of hair.
Yeah, 90 years old, has more hair than Brad and I combined.
Yes. James, I'd ask you to get him on, but I might say some hurtful things.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna take responsibility for the things I might say to somebody with a full head of hair when they're 90 years old.
I mean, I make a point to not have my hair cut too short because it grows so fast that it gets really awkward lengths immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You do have a lot of hair, but like sometimes it looks weird. That's a great point. That makes me feel better about my situation. Thanks, James. The
I can't, like, I try to buzz the sides and back to be like all stylish and whatever, but I mean,
yeah.
It's just so too fast.
You got so much hair.
Too much.
Overabundance, man. That could potentially be a really good transition into today's conversation, but I'm not even ready yet.
I'm not totally sure how it could be.
We just go with it, James. You just run with it. You're like, so much abundance. There was so much abundance in the voting population that identified as evangelical Christians that in the 60s, they had to tap into that. They saw a potential to transform a certain party, and those voters were split, and they fixed that. Oh, transition. Bow, 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 bow. I got there.
There you go.
I got there. James is covering his entire face with his beard right now.
It was a rough road, but we got there.
Hey, listen, it's not always about the journey. It's about the destination.
Yeah.
I thought it was supposed to be the opposite of that.
It probably is. But I tried to make it seem okay.
I like listening to podcasts where the people that are really hosting it and support, like, they unquestionably support each other and help them even when they stumble instead of just tearing them apart.
Yeah, which podcast is that?
That's a good point. No one listens to those podcasts. They want to hear y'all ream me. They do. Our listeners enjoy it.
I know the podcast you listen to, and that's not
true. Yeah, that's true. I know. I listen to some really, like, terribly raunchy podcasts, and they all riff on each other constantly, and I kind of love it. So
basically just anything from the 700 network.
That's basically my lineup. That's a great point.
That could be a nice segue as well.
Right.
No, one of my favorites right now is Podcasts on the Left, and they pick the most, just, they do like the most heinous serial killers, like alien abductions, like the most ridiculous topics. And they are, I don't know if they would listen to our podcast. They kind of pretend like they actually follow Satan, which they don't, but it's, one of them may, but it's, one of them, one
they
of them
don't.
Might. Yeah, they do.
They
don't.
The old pretending to worship Satan
They do a lot of Hail Satans, but really, like, modern Satanists are really humanists in disguise that, like, I think, scaring modern Christians by saying they're Satanists for the most part.
What's that disguise look like?
It's mainly, like, red spandex and maybe some sort of headdress, potentially a cape, and then like cadavers.
I feel like until the very end it was, you were describing an outfit that you would wear.
Are you saying that I'm maybe a closeted Satanist? Is that what's happening right now?
Or a closeted humanist that dresses like they're pretending to be a Satanist?
I may be closer to that. Like, unfortunately, that may be pretty spot on. But I was hoping that if we, you know, stayed with this podcast, that I would finally convert to Christianity, so my whole family would be happy. But, like, I'm almost there. I'm almost there. If y'all keep going, I'll be there for sure.
I mean, I feel like I could see you at the next 5K in town, running by in red spandex with a red cape and a headdress of some sort.
Maybe two little horns and a smile.
Possibly.
Chasing the children. Come here, children! like that crazy statue they supposedly were about to put up, right, at Oklahoma City's, what was it, their Capitol building?
Yeah, the Capitol building, yeah.
With the children that are coming to the beck and call of Satan. I don't know how that statue was going to be dressed, but I'm pretty sure I could outdress them. So you should see me in red spandex.
I have.
It's empowering. It's empowering.
I was hoping that your question was going to be, do either of you know a place where I could go shopping for some spandex? But it took a very different turn. And I was going to say, we could point you towards a place in Charlottesville, or Charlotte, North Carolina. Because
I think you need to tell the story in full.
I went with David while he was looking for some spandex, and I have watched David try on a plethora of different styles and colors and patterns, all sorts of things, as he paraded around a store with some poor ladies, poor young ladies that worked there, not sure what to think, as he came bursting out of the changing room, which I don't think you were supposed to do, trying on various tank tops and spandex.
I feel like they were a little bit into it. Like, they were at least enjoying it.
Not at first.
They were enjoying...
At first, they were not sure what to think about what was happening.
I think they were enjoying their day just a little bit more, because I wasn't homeless. Like, I wasn't... Like, they knew I was in there to buy something.
What homeless people go try on tank tops and spandex?
The best homeless people. The homeless people that I want to hang out with.
Oh. So none of them, you don't want to hang out with any homeless people.
Dude, unless they're willing to go into an American Apparel and try on spandex without underwear and not buy any, I don't know. I could be convinced. I could be convinced to hang out with them, but...
I just imagined Squirrel and Shelby and T-Bone and all those guys wearing spandex to Hope House. That would not have been a good week.
It probably wouldn't have gone over well, no.
What were you doing trying on spandex? That's never been established. We're just kind of letting that go. And I'm
just
not
a day
really
in the life.
No, the assumption is day it's just life. A day in the life of me. And that assumption would be correct. Yeah, James was...
He still has those.
Yeah, I do.
I've seen those at your
Absolutely.
House.
Absolutely. I get them out on special occasions when I want to make Lacey May uncomfortable. It's been a long time since I've been in the spandex and danced on her. But
David had a... Was it, what was it, your 30th birthday that was a spandex birthday party?
That's right. At the old friendly local bowling alley.
Yep, everybody had to wear spandex.
Except for our pastor, who decided to opt out, which I'm still a little upset with. And he wonders why I don't call him to get coffee. And believe me, that's the root of it. I think he does occasionally listen to our podcast. I hope he heard me say that. And I hope he immediately goes out and buys spandex. He's got real long legs. He's a pretty tall guy.
Sunday night.
But yeah, exactly. He's a pretty tall guy. I think he could find some, though. He may have to special order it off of, like, I don't know, online somewhere, some company that special. Because American Apparel doesn't exist anymore, if I'm correct. I believe they declared bankruptcy.
Right.
There's a company called ASOS, I think. ASOS, A-S-O-S. Listeners,
just keep trying.
I think it's ASOS.com.
We'll look it up later and edit it down to whatever. Just say
every company called applesauce.com. I believe that they sell some really fantastic, tight action. So look that up, listeners.
I have
let us know.
Some American flag tights that I got for that occasion that now I mostly just use to make my family all feel really awkward on holidays.
Not only July 4th, it's not just Independence Day. It's occasionally Thanksgiving, maybe Christmas, maybe Easter. James in a giant bunny head and those tights really get the children going.
That's right.
Families are totally comfortable with their children hanging out with James when they see him in that apparel. They know that he can connect with them on a real level.
Yep.
To the folks listening to this podcast right now that haven't opted out of this wonderful episode, if you do have American Apparel, like American flag apparel, like you've seen American Apparel, if you have American flag apparel and you want to put it on at this point, if you want to pause us and put those American flag boxers on to get ready for this episode, I think we'd appreciate it. So we'll see you in a minute, decked out in your American flag apparel, as we talked about the moral majority. It's conversations like that that led evangelical leaders in the late 50s and 60s to come together and advocate for a moral majority to change the way the political landscape was going in the United States.
Hey, David, thanks for that transition. I appreciate that.
That was me winking. Winky.
Right. So this week's quote is from Richard Dawkins, which is a very well-known atheist, you know, in all different circles. He wrote a book called The God Delusion and a couple other books. But he has a quote that I read on the internet a couple weeks ago, and It goes like this. It says, secularism is categorically not saying that the religious may not speak out publicly or have a say in public life. It is about saying that religion alone should not confer a privileged say in public life or greater influence on it. It really is as simple as that. So, James, we were talking earlier about that, and that spoke to you in a specific way. So you want to go into that?
Sure. So in looking at like what he's saying in that quote, it seems like he is saying that religion is totally fine as an aspect of our country and our belief systems, whatever, that we base how we run the country on, but that it doesn't deserve its own privileged spot, right? So the church shouldn't have more power than any other institution. I was just having the question, before we really get into where that power came from, or are we being persecuted as a church because of, you know, not having prayer in schools or whatever, is that the case? Or I was wondering, as an initial question, should we as a church, Big C Church, even want to have government influence and national influence?
So for me personally, when I think about the power of government, the power of media, the power of politics in this country, and the influence that it has on our daily lives, on other people's daily lives, I can definitely see why church leaders, Christians, etc., want to make sure that they have a say, that they have a seat at the table or multiple seats at the table, especially when it comes to Supreme Court decisions, to policy decisions that affect our day-to-day life that may go in the opposite direction of what Christians believe. Like it doesn't offend me that people want to be a part of that conversation and absolutely influence it. Basically, it makes sense for the Christians in this country to want to be at that table, to want to be decision makers in that conversation, and to influence policy when that policy has a direct impact on their day-to-day and may interfere with their ability to practice what they believe. And yeah, I think it would be stranger for them not want to have any aspect in that governance when that governance has such a strong influence on our country.
Yeah, I mean, well, religion plays a huge part, obviously, in everybody's life. And so a lot of decisions that people make revolve around some type of faith aspect. I know a lot of decisions that I've made have revolved around some form of faith aspect that may have evolved over time, but a lot of things I've said, a lot of things I've done, a lot of things, you know, I've done with different people has revolved around that. So, I mean, I can see where the need to want your values represented in government, and I think that's valid. But when I hear the quote, I think what he's saying, and I think even Dawkins wasn't saying that that's not valid. I think what he's trying to say is that that shouldn't be the only voice.
Sure.
And it shouldn't be, you know, the whole rhetoric of, well, this was a Christian nation, so that should be what everybody talks about. You know, that type of notion, I think, is what he's referring to.
When I look back at the founding of this country and a clear focus on religious freedom, that doesn't point to religious freedom only for Christianity or this being a Christian nation.
No.
And I know that's a common misconception in popular culture and in government, that was the focus and that our founding fathers were all Bible-thumping Christians, which unfortunately, they weren't. I don't know where that narrative came from. Some of them were Christians, but many of them were deists or, I don't know, pretended to basically follow some sort of Bible doctrine.
And people also came here and murdered everybody that was already here. Like, I find a hard time saying, this was founded on Christian values.
See, that's manifest, by killing that's everybody manifest present. Destiny. That's that's Americans pretending that they're Jewish, pretending that they're part of the Old Testament, pretending that they're that America is the promised land. It's the biggest farce of our of our history, and it's gotten us to where we are today. I'm sorry, American Indians, for the smallpox blankets, the mass genocide, and basically scrubbing you from the existence in our history books. But you can see how, if I was Dawkins and I'm looking at that history, I'm saying, like, this is what y'all's voice at the table has gotten, is the mass genocide of that group, and then the advocacy for slavery in America, which was also spearheaded by Christian groups in the South.
And the avoidance of women's rights, yeah, and all sorts of things.
No wonder he's trying to get a couple more voices at that table. He's like, guys, we need more of a moral majority conversation because the Christians are in charge and it's not going well.
Mm-hmm.
At least historically back then. I don't think that's true today by any stretch of imagination. But
so, James, what do you think?
I will tend to aim back towards, in talking about things of what the church should do and believe, I tend to think that the church is supposed to be followers of Jesus. And so looking at Jesus and then looking at people who would have known Jesus or knew people who knew Jesus and so started out following his teaching, so the early church, looking at those two, that person and then people group, is probably our best bet in trying to figure out what things should look like for us. And I was listening to some stuff on the early church recently, and they were talking about the process of being admitted into the church and being officially a Christian back in the day. And there's a whole lot, I won't go into all of it, but basically there was a 3-year period of being essentially sponsored and discipled by a leader in the church until you then were taught doctrine for the last couple weeks, and then they would do an exorcism on everybody before they came into the church, where they had to swear against and expel these demons from their lives that were on various subjects. But there were 5 main ones that they really focused on, that they had everybody kind of renounce the power of that demon, as they would say, in their lives. You know, there was the typical idolatry, violence, greed, that kind of stuff. But one of the main 5 that they made everybody have to swear against was xenophobia. Because the idea of being against any nationality, any people group, because of where they were from, wasn't seen as something that could be done in the church. And so the idea to me of focusing on a government and therefore one people group over another doesn't make sense to me for something the church should be striving for. And I don't understand how you can be so powerfully involved in one. Well, I mean, especially with, I mean, look how things are going now. I mean, right now the church is speaking up strongly in politics, and what's continually being said is America first. We need to build more walls. We need to keep foreigners out. We need to kick out any foreigners that are here. There's a fear of foreigners right now that the early church would have called a demon.
Yeah.
So I just don't understand that. It just feels like our focus as a church now is a power grab. And right now that's being done through politics, and it has been for, you know, a few decades since this idea of the moral majority grew. But I mean, we're doing power grabs, which is, it's amazing that a church built on the idea of the last shall be first and the first shall be last, we're all trying to be first. It's amazing to me.
But see, that idea hasn't, in my life in church, in my understanding of church, that idea has never been present in organized religion.
Which idea?
The idea of you quoting Christ, of the last will be first, the first will be last. Like, I have not seen that in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, like, at all. That idea being in a organized, powerful church body, at least in the United States, regardless of what sect of Christianity is, that is a maybe a counterintuitive thought or belief to an organization that wants to grow and wants to be quote unquote successful in this country.
Right. And which is interesting because we've grown into the church in America has had crazy amounts of power over the past 100 years, and the church is dying really quick. It's really bad. And yet, during the time that I'm talking about, when they avoided politics in other people's countries because they were building a country separate of, or a kingdom separate of country lines and everything, like everybody could be a member of this kingdom despite their nation. And when they were focused on that, every 10 years they grew by 40%.
And that global concept
for 300
that
years.
Global concept of Christianity doesn't really have much of a presence in my understanding of basically U.S. Christianity or churches. Would you right. agree with that? Like, I don't see it. I don't see this idea of like, oh yeah, well, we'll throw some money towards missions or whatever, but this global idea of like, we're all part of the body of Christ. Like, no, we're a part of our body that meets on Sunday in this building.
Right.
Yeah. And like, maybe we're part of like the larger, I don't know, Presbyterian or Baptist conference or whatever, but like, yeah, that's it. So real quick, before we continue diving down this way, we keep throwing out this term of moral majority or this politicizing of the church that happened. We referenced that occurring maybe in the 60s, I believe.
It really got going in the late 70s.
Okay. Brad, do you want to just quickly define that for our listeners?
Yeah, so this is the thing that came to my mind when I heard this quote was the moral majority. It's a phrase that I've heard a few times. It gets thrown out some after the last election. And it really got me thinking that I wanted to go back and do a little research. So I went back and I started looking at where this may have gotten started. And the first thing that started happening was actually in the 50s. If you remember in the 50s, one of the big things that was happening in the 50s was blacklisting of Hollywood and all of that, the scare of communism coming into the United States. And that did not escape the evangelical movement in the United States. The late Billy Graham, and during his Christian Crusades, which were going on in the 50s, he would speak on this communism, and it was causing a lot of fear in the United States. And during a lot of his sermons, he would mention that communism was a war on God, and that communism was a war on the individual. You hear that phrase a lot in the moral majority, which is the individual. The war on the individual. You still hear that today, all the time. After the 50s, when John F. Kennedy came into power, John F. Kennedy was well known as being a Catholic. And the evangelical church was concerned about the Catholic being in office because they feared that it was going to take away from the individualism that they were searching for and that they believed God was providing, or God wanted, I guess is a better way of saying that. And they actually confronted him in meetings. There's videos of them having town hall meetings where they're confronting him about this. Where this really started taking off was in 1970s. In the 1970s is when Roe versus Wade was, which was the legalization of abortion, to which evangelicals could not believe that people would have such little value for human life.
I will push back on that, actually.
Okay.
Because during that is not when that happened. It wasn't until 6 years later that was the push, because
the
president of the Southern Baptist Convention and every major publication of evangelicals praised Roe versus Wade. It was viewed as a victory for Christians when Roe versus Wade happened, because they said that this is showing that there's not going to be any encroachment on our rights, individual rights are saved, that sort of thing.
So from a federal perspective, it was actually defending the sacred right of the individual.
Yes, yeah. That was the view. And so they loved it. They were very happy about it.
Until...
No, I absolutely agree with you. There's another phrase that you hear all the time. You still hear it now. I heard it last week by a friend of mine. But the thing you always hear about is how we have removed God from schools. God has been removed from schools. And I wanted to go back and I wanted to look at where did this come from? What are they talking about? What is this about? And it actually happened in the 1960s. And there was two Supreme Court decisions that happened in the early 1960s. In 1962, there was a Supreme Court decision in Engle versus Vital, or Vitali, which was about prayer. And what it says is this: prayer approved by the New York Board of Regents for use in schools violates the First Amendment rights because it represents establishment of religion. Now remember, it did not say that an individual cannot go to school and pray. It does not say that. What it says is that it cannot have a school force all of their students to go through a prayer. In 1963, in Abington School District versus Shep, the Supreme Court basically had the exact same ruling on the reading of Bible verses.
Right.
Because they used to read a Bible verse at the beginning of school before everybody got going. And they ruled that that was unconstitutional because of the First Amendment rights of people who did not believe in that. So when you hear people talk about removing God from schools, those are the two court cases that they are referring to. And I think it's complete BS.
Yeah.
Because in fact, I think it's arrogance, because in no way did the government try to take away an individual's right to pray or to read the Bible in school. When we were going through high school, I know I went to multiple See You at the Poll rallies at our school.
Yeah.
We would have FCA. We would have all kinds of things. And not once did the school say anything about that. Did the state say anything about that? It's complete arrogance to think that somehow this one court case removed God. Like, how arrogant is that we think that God suddenly left because we can't have a corporate prayer? Like, that makes no sense.
Right. We also feel like, I guess this is the part where the quote is aiming towards, of the place of prominence of that individual religion. Because I can imagine families being in an uproar if they read in the morning, if they had prayer to God, and then mats put out for people to, you know, bow towards Mecca and do a prayer for Allah, and then read
the Quran.
Bible verse, and then a verse from the Quran. People would be just so mad, because, like, how can you possibly do that? And I understand the view of Christians saying that creationism is the way everything started, but we don't allow the creation stories of any other religion to be in science classes. That's the place of prominence that it's talking about.
That's because it's not scientific. But additionally, if the United States was a majority Muslim country from its founding, and we made a decision in the 60s to take prayer, laying down mats, you know, and then reading from the Quran out of the school, there would be outrage, because a group that is in power is losing some aspect of power. And I think that for the evangelicals, like, they absolutely felt like they were under attack in the 50s and 60s. You get a Catholic president, and then they're taking prayer out of school, like, and we have the sexual revolution occurring, like, during these decades. Everybody's going to get my son pregnant with all their sexy short shorts and Where's God? Well,
going back to the conversation of the moral majority and where that came from, I mean, the entry point of trying to build a moral majority wasn't Roe versus Wade. It wasn't that case. So there was a court case that started that path, though. And that court case was when there was a Christian college that there was an attempt to force them to desegregate. And they said, that's not fair. They said, well, they weren't going to force them to desegregate. They said, you will lose your tax-exempt status as a Christian college if you don't desegregate, because desegregation was being forced all around the country. And that's when they said, well, fine, you're going to press upon our rights. We're going to fight back.
So fast forward to 1978, and a guy by the name of Jerry Falwell Sr. was basically pressured by a lot of his fellow pastors, fellow Christian leaders.
And real quick, isn't his son the president of Liberty University now?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's his, yeah. Basically, he was picked to be the spokesperson, if you will, of this movement that they wanted to get started. Going back a little bit before that, President Carter was elected in 1976 to be president. President Carter was the first president to come out as a
born-again Christian, basically.
As a born-again Christian. And at the time, it completely shocked the media. They didn't know what to do with it. In fact, they thought it was a political stunt at the time. They thought he was only doing that to, you know, just keep up appearances or something, because nobody previous to that had ever gone on every Sunday to church. Like, that was just unheard of at the time.
And before that, Brad, to jump in, before that, so Billy Graham had actually backed Nixon prior to that, right? And he had moved, he basically moved the evangelicals to vote in a moral, upright Christian president. Nixon then has Watergate scandal occur. Graham obviously feels like he's been totally screwed over, that the Christians have been attacked. So they look for the next president that's going to be basically this mirror image of a Christian man. And that's when
After Jimmy Carter gets, you're absolutely correct. And after Jimmy Carter gets elected, that basically gave evangelicals, and I keep saying evangelicals, but that's literally the movement that this is talking about. So I'm not trying to single them out, but that's just who it is. That's just who this was. That gave evangelicals the freedom in their own mind to exalt their faith in public, essentially, in everyday life. This is when the Christian industry got started. This is when Christian books, Christian music, Christian television, all of those things came out after Jimmy Carter was elected president. And this became big business. And everyone knew that this was big business. So now they start to have a voice. And again, in 1978, Jerry Falwell is elected to be the person who goes on the attack against abortion. And they start talking about the moral majority. He actually started a company called Moral Majority Incorporated in 1979. They claim to be nonpartisan. They claim that they oppose feminists or feminism in general. And of course, they also went against homosexuality.
Right.
Which, let's restate, was the absolute norm in the 70s for the general population to be obviously anti-gay.
Right. It was. But that was definitely one of the platforms that they constantly brought up. At this time, there was also a network of Christian colleges that was beginning to arise. Liberty University, some others, probably the one that James mentioned.
Bob Jones University.
They were recognized as being vital to the grassroots movement of beginning to create a moral majority movement of
evangelicals. I bet Oral Roberts was a part of that as well in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
I'm sure they were.
And I do have a question before we go any farther here. There's a statement that was said by one of the leaders of the moral majority that said, America has always stood up for the dignity of human life. Do you agree with that?
No.
Well, if human life is defined as the white man, then absolutely.
But that's such a tight window.
Of course it is. I'm being facetious, but yeah.
Right, I understand. I'm just saying the white man. Like, every one of those is important because people got here and murder the Native Americans.
Right.
People enslaved Chinese, African American, anybody that wasn't a white man. Women didn't have rights because they weren't white men. And then they started narrowing it down to making sure you had enough money to have an opinion. Like, there's all these limits on who was valuable. So, no, our country's has been built on the idea of this select few over anyone else, no matter what we have to do to those people.
Mm-hmm. Well, and and I'm not dismissing this because I definitely agree with you. Even if you were to dismiss all of what you just said, even if you just take it what they're talking about here, the majority, you know, they were totally fighting for an infant child, unborn child's life, but they say nothing of the death penalty, and they say nothing of war.
Right. Well,
which means that's human life as well. So,
but that's the thing. They don't say nothing about war because we talked about this quote earlier, and he goes on to say that they need to build a bigger military, right?
Who's he?
And so that's the thing. It's even saying it's not about sanctity of life. It's about sanctity of these select few American lives.
Right.
And who are you referencing there? This or that?
So that was Jerry Falwell Sr. So yeah, he jumped ahead a little bit. The big win for the moral majority was Ronald Reagan in 1980 getting elected. He was believed to be the guy who was going to embody the principles of the evangelical world. In fact, the quote he was just referencing was the day after Ronald Reagan got elected, Jerry Falwell Sr. has a press conference where he makes the following statement. He said, "Finally today, we finally have a president that will pass a human life amendment, which would effectively end abortion. 2, return voluntary prayer to schools," which actually Ronald Reagan tried to have an amendment passed right as after he got elected to return voluntary prayer to schools, and it did not pass. And 3, restore the country to 1 in the world in military might for the cause of freedom and peace. And at the same time, there was a lot of liberal senators and House of Representatives members that got ousted out of the Senate and House of Representatives. So it became a majority Republican House, Senate, and President. And they believed that at that point, they were going to start to push the moral majority views.
Right.
And then they got a lesson in what politics actually is. What I also found interesting is that they believed that Ronald Reagan, they were for welfare at the time because they believed that that kept families together. And nowadays it's completely flipped. Now they believe that welfare is the drain of America and all this stuff. But back then, welfare was loved because it kept families together.
Right. I mean, I've heard welfare pitched as the reason why there's fatherless homes in the black community is because welfare was used door to door to tell black women that they didn't need no man, that they could just do it on their own with this welfare check.
Right.
And so that's the reason that there's fatherless homes, not the prison system.
Yeah, I was
system.
Like,
and
what men are that. You talking no, it's about, not that. James? We put them all in prison.
Yeah, it's not that.
They're moving drugs, not that. Or it's, they didn't yeah, pay
it's,
a
it's not the things that we can
ticket.
Take personal responsibility towards playing a part in. It's obviously welfare. That's what's doing it.
Yeah.
To me, the whole point of this is that this all started out of fear. Fear of communism first, fear of losing your voice. But I would argue that when you look at the Bible in general, Old Testament, New Testament, Jesus' teachings, he warned against this repeatedly. Establishing power. The passage that constantly comes to my mind is one that's been, I've heard a lot of podcasts about it, read a lot about it, read the Bible passage about it, but it's in 1 Kings with Solomon when the Queen of Sheba comes to him and says, "Surely God has blessed you to bring favor on your people." Solomon was basically becoming an arms dealer. and was buying chariots and horses and selling them. He was amassing wealth. He was building military bases. He was doing essentially what America's doing now. And he even built his temples out of slave labor. The people who had just been brought out of Exodus or out of Egypt, he used those people to build his temple with slave labor. I mean, there's a huge warning of what this can be. And then obviously Israel goes through, you know, hell after that. So that's what keeps coming to my mind, is like this type of stuff. So to answer your question earlier, James, no, I don't think they should be seeking power. I don't think we as a church should be seeking power.
I mean, something you had mentioned was the communist movement and stuff. And I think it's amazing that where some of these standpoints come from that I hear people mention all the time of, you know, it even says God, in God we trust, on our money, and, you know, it's in the Pledge of Allegiance and all that stuff. That was us trying to be the good guys. And then in the Cold War,
mm-hmm.
like, that's all that was. We were like, there's going to be a war between us and Russia. Let's be the good guys by saying things about God. Mm-hmm. That's when that was added onto the money and put in the pledge and all of that stuff. It wasn't a national thing from, you know, the time America was founded to have language of God interlaced in all of the things that we do. Mm-hmm. It was in response to things. And I think to be responsible Americans and Christians, if you're going to couple the two in what you're trying to be, you need to look at the things that you're claiming and why those things are in place and how all that functions. Because to just blindly say, well, it says in God we trust on our money, sure, but why?
Mm-hmm.
And what about what this country has done and is doing has anything to do with God?
Ironically, mm-hmm. It was President Eisenhower who declared, in God we trust must appear on American currency, in 1956.
Yep.
Whoa! Mm-hmm. Full circle, buddy. Woo! Mm-hmm. I love that. I had
a military leader.
Dude, I had no idea that they only added that in the 50s, dude. You just blew my mind.
Yep.
That's crazy. Holy smokes.
And even if you look at the 21st century, I mean, it wasn't until President George W. Bush that people really considered him to be the first evangelical president. And look at if you go back and you start to look at how he used the church to get elected,
mm-hmm.
in Texas, and how he used the church to get elected for president, and how he manipulated a lot of the ways that his dad got elected. And when you look at after 9/11, look at the terminology that he constantly uses when he talks about the war in Iraq. It was always good versus evil, and yep. good will prevail. He made it a holy war, openly.
Oh, he didn't write those speeches, Brad. Come on.
You're probably right, but
his group of advisors, his vice president, made it a holy war. He just went along with it.
I mean, just because he had other people write the official thing didn't mean he didn't, you know, influence which way it was going to go.
Right. I'm not saying he was no Trump. Yeah.
He was no Trump throwing out the notes, but still.
Well, going back, I don't know, there's a parallel between what you're talking about, Brad, and then 2018, right? Though, I mean, we have a majority, like a Republican president, House and Senate majority across the board,
mm-hmm.
that were elected and supported by this moral majority that you're talking about that was created in the 60s, 70s, that believed in a Ronald Reagan. And even Reagan, historically, is still put on a pedestal with the majority of Republicans as the quintessential, like, this is our John Wayne, you know? He was an actor,
mm-hmm.
that was on the nose on purpose. But it will be interesting to see, you know, we're putting our trust in government. We're putting our trust in men, which, going back to the Bible, going back to the New Testament, like, Jesus had every opportunity to take the traditional road of power and to take the Israelites and put them on top and dethrone Rome, and chose not to, and instead followed God and opted into dying a horrible death and then being resurrected. Was that all in vain, or was that, you know, was he trying to demonstrate to humanity that power, wealth, prestige, it's the road to ruin and not the road to success, which the United States clearly thinks those three things are absolutely the road to success. That's what we care about. I watch the Oscars on Sunday. I know these things. And I get excited about celebrities. Like, I'm as guilty as the next man. Gets excited about, you know, oh, what if I was a millionaire? Ooh, what would I do to change the world? Christ didn't barely had a penny to his name, man. They didn't have pennies back then, but whatever money they used, I don't know.
So in trying to kind of cycle all of this into like a cohesive summarized thing, I guess for me, what I would say in response to the quote that we are kind of basing this off of, or as a starting point, and cycling back around to kind of answer my question from the beginning, I don't think that the church needs to be trying to hold on to power politically. I would agree that the church has lost a lot of political power in this country, and maybe that's the best thing for it. Like, for the health of the church, maybe not having the power of the world is a good idea. Because I don't know how we can love our enemy as ourself while running a nation.
A nation that's supposed to protect itself and not its enemy. Absolutely. And also, you think back to the Red Scare, the anti-communist... Basically,
the fear of redheads.
Yeah, the fear of redheads, which, guys, I'm still here. Suck it!
The old Red Scare.
No, but if you think about the Red Scare, the fear of gingers, / communist nations, because they're trying to stamp out Christianity, and you think about the global church and where the church truly actually means something to individuals on such a powerful level. Like, my mind immediately goes to China, right? Like, when you think about the churches that they have in homes, constantly being under threat and growing, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but growing at an exponential rate. It's not the United States. It's a country that forbids Christianity. So, yeah.
Well, with that, we'll go ahead and end this episode. I'm Brad Stair.
I'm David Meggs.
I'm James Eisenhower.
And everything is okay, people.
As if a brighter pain could be imagined. As if those years spent pulverized by feelings of inadequacy and loss of faith were coming back. As if I never saw the flip side of beauty I never knew existed. As if home left with you. As if 1 million of the blackest thoughts took its place. As if God knows something I don't. Rusty tools in the barn like mine. I walk among the meandering vines, but I never saw the lights on the track of speeding forward to an unfortunate meeting. Reaping what I sowed, I know I was plowed under edible plants and full grown. Their roots poked holes like stars in the sky in the seat of my pants. And I tried to fly by when I wanna be big, but I'm new and I'm green. I wanna be near, but it's more of a leap. I search like a bloodhound pressed in the perforated comp Midwest. I rest. I take breaths like death hasn't won me over yet. I'm the best of the best. There's a nest in the barn where the owl has eggs. I crack, I drink, I'm a predator yet. Sliding into symbolism, my engine and my cynicism. Get these women back to the house, back to the porch. No doubt what you're missing about three cows, two cribs full of corn, two kids, and a horn full of plenty in the storm. Bake this till the breeze brings us to God, and the rain takes hold of the side. I nod at the clouds while the funnel comes down. No town for miles around that we are found. Smack dab in the middle of the last days on earth. Such a wonderful place to have rusty tools in a barn like mine. I bow down to philandering minds, locked up in the human form of an organism dead that never was born. Tell me how you feel. Tell me how you feel. Tell me how you feel. Tell me how you feel.
Rusty joints inside sockets unsoaked. I divide my way amid motorized hopes. Hope I never felt the tires on the asphalt bleed themselves all loose from underneath me. Yet I made it my life to not make it my life, and I abide in blindness, I rigidity. While your eyes poked holes like stars in the sky, inside the yellow bars I tried to live by. I called out the god with those sinus nights. Get left in the bag and back of my mind. I'm fine, dolled up and twined, but I guess my pride's underwear of a prettier dress. My quest, my drug, my plight, everything I held up close to the lights, up close to the mic. I write, I'm wrong on the edge of the razor. When my song is a word from a misspent piston, greased up by a real good Christian. Good, better, best, bestest, west is the side of the city where I rest. This heavy head levitating, waiting on the Chevy red paint, dry nights on my twin size bed. I dread like hell the end of the world, the end of the tour, like a death knell. Girl, now, like glass, I shine and reflect beauty and dirt, a light from my chest, akin to my grand. I'm gonna make it my final spend and not end up cold like them. Rusty joints inside sockets unsoaked. I navigate inside of the dangling ropes, cause I'm locked up in the human form of an organism dead that never was born. And pouring grain, we still feel frail. Well, that all we know is real. Separate cans of cans and let cancer dance in this ass is land where we're standing. We're branded with banner and ambush, brothers and sisters crammed in a van. But these hands we fight with might just light me up from the inside. We rust and in pouring grain, we still feel frail. Well, that all we know is real. Separate cans of cans and let cancer dance in this ass is land where we're standing. We're branded with banner and ambush, brothers and sisters crammed in a van. But these hands we fight with might just light me up from the inside.
As if there is an answer to every question, and as if grace is the answer. As if I don't know everything I thought I knew. As if I'm not as good as I thought I was. As if my bitterest fears have come true when I realize how much I still have for which to be thankful. As if happiness isn't an emotion to cover up symptoms of the disease, but that happiness is the triumphant absence of the self-loathing and insecure germs that are currently writhing in my heart of hearts. As if happiness is peace, and peace is found in something bigger than love. As if there is an answer to every question, and as if grace is that answer.
Tell me how you feel.